Welcome to Warships Pod, and for this episode, we're delighted to have as our guest Michael G. Wellham, author of the excellent book Combat Divers, which is an in-depth look, pardon the pun, at the history and current-day world of some rather special military people who operate under the water. Michael has been involved with diving, both military and civilian, for some 40 years, and was a Royal Marines commando with skills in diving, canoeing and parachuting. He was also a member of 21 Special Air Service Regiment and of 95 Commando Naval Gunfire Support Royal Artillery, both British elite reserve units. Welcome, Mike.
Good morning.
And I guess combat divers is a pretty mysterious world to most of us. And so I wonder if we could start off with a definition of a combat diver. What's the scope of those whom we may see, you know, as such? Can you give us a brief outline?
Yeah, I personally, for the purpose of the books, have broadened the scope of it. If you, for example, if you talk to the US Army, a combat diver is Green Beret Special Forces trained to be able to use the closed circuit equipment to infiltrate wherever they've got to go. I've broadened that because I include mine warfare divers and divers that are also engaged. It's a combat situation, you know, it's military and it's diving. So it's a broader scope than just, you know, the what we see as the guy with the closed circuit equipment on sticking a mine on the side of a ship. So it's broader than that, the scope. But that's the generally perceived, and that comes, I think, from the war. You know, we had these people in these rubber suits and things, and they were called frogmen because they looked like frogs, and they had quite specific tasks. But I suppose they, as they evolved, they did separate. You know, we did have people that specialised on mines, and as opposed to the guys that went in and measured up a beach and removed obstacles. So it's a broad brush, really, when you look at, in my view, of combat diving. It's a military person that's using diving to achieve an end.
So that means it can embrace people from the Navy, the Army, across all three armed forces, would you say?
All three armed forces, yes. For example, the US Air Force, which I don't mention in the book, but, you know, they have a Special Forces Combat Divers unit, which is used for finding their airplanes if they crash in shallow water so that they can recover them. So they're quite a specialised unit. So, yes, it's a broad brush.
What exactly is it that attracts people to what is, as you highlight in the book, a very demanding and a very dangerous job? I mean, even within the world of special forces or elite forces, combat diving is probably up there in the most dangerous, would you say?
Well, it is. For a start, you're going into an alien environment. You're going into water and you're using equipment to do it, breathing equipment. And so you're going to be relying on that equipment. And if that doesn't work, your options are you come to the surface. And, of course, as soon as you're on the surface, you're exposed. So that can add to all the problems. It can compromise an operation, a mission, because, you know, if you're seen and found, it's all over. And you just hope that your buddies that are with you get away. So, yeah, I think that's probably the easiest way of describing it.
But is it a particular kind of person? For example, you know, is it somebody who is a risk taker or somebody who's cautious? Is it somebody who you would look at in the street and think, well, they look like they're a pretty macho kind of person that would go beneath the sea to do these special operations? I mean, is there any one particular kind of person?
No, there isn't. They're all shapes and sizes, ages. We now have, you know, male and female operatives, which is evolving and developing. There isn't a one size fits all. It's a particular person. You can either want to do it and can pass the course and then do it because you want to, because you're, I suppose, attracted to what you do when you're doing it. You're an individual. If you're on an operation, it might be just two of you swimming underwater, in not being able to see each other, going in to do, you know, a mission, a target, a landing, or attacking a ship or whatever. And it's, I suppose it's, you're looking at individuals that come together in a team, but it'll be a very small team. I never liked big organisations. I always wanted to be in a smaller group where you have an input, and you know, if you've got to play the part and do your bit to make the rest of it work. Whereas, you know, you could be in the infantry and you just sit down and everybody else carries on going, you know, rather than. So I suppose it's a challenge. So you want to do it.
And are you able to say to us what made you personally look at the world of diving in the military? Are you able to give us an insight into that?
Yeah, I loved swimming as a youngster and spent a lot of time doing it whenever I could. And I think I was about 10 years old. My father took me to a Navy Days. And when we got in there, we went into this swimming pool. And these guys dressed in all their underwater equipment did a demonstration. They were swimming around in the pool. There was no bubbles coming off. And they were just quietly going around. And they had a mock ship in the middle of the pool. And one of them stuck a mine on it. And it blew up. And I just said to my father, that's what I'm going to do. And that was it. And all channels went in that direction.
Right. So you presumably as a lad read some of those old paperbacks and things like that. That would be the early history, as we would think of it, of combat diving, you know, World War II, etc. But when did modern combat diving actually start, as we would understand it?
Oh, it is the Second World War. It started, I suppose, the main part of it, the main thrust of it started in Gibraltar with the Italians. The Italians, we had lots of ships in Gibraltar carrying stores to North Africa. And then the Italians had devised closed circuit underwater equipment, very light, small, rubber suits, fins on their feet. So they had developed all of this. And then they had this torpedo that they could leave the warhead that's at the front underneath the warship and depart and get away, and then the ship would blow up. So that was the start of it. And then they had groups, lots and lots of individuals that would just go into the water and swim with mines and stick them on ships. And of course, we had nothing like that at all. And so we had to create a defence, which was done. Our guys in the initial stages, and there was two of them in Gibraltar, they had swimming trunks, weighted plimsolls on their feet, and the submarine escape equipment, which is designed so somebody could get from a submarine and get to the surface, and that was it. And these guys were diving on. That's what they used to dive 24 hours a day, night or day, winter and summer. It didn't matter. That's what they had. How they did it, I have no idea. You know, I have spoken to some of these guys a few years ago, you know, and they just said, well, it was a job and we got on with it. You know, we knew it was going to be hazardous and we got on and did it. So that was the initial start. And of course, as soon as we got the ball rolling, the other groups set up. So we had people that could go into the beaches, people that could canoe up rivers and attack ships and that area. So that's when it really started.
And when you were mentioning those people in their sort of swimming trunks and the weighted plimsolls, etc., I was thinking of the famous Buster Crabb. So, I mean, was he one of the key pioneers on the British side of it, would you say?
Yes, he was. There's no question of it. I mean, he went to Gibraltar as a bomb disposal officer, and he said that, you know, that was how his responsibility. So I've got to learn how to do this. So they put him in a pair of swimming trunks and this submarine escape kit. He climbed down a ladder, went to the bottom of it, breathing under there, and then came out. And they said, right, you're a diver now. We'll go out there and start checking on ships. And now that was the training. And he was a very poor swimmer anyway. But he set it up and led it and started to evolve and get more people in. And they started recruiting and building up a unit.
But how did they actually encourage people to do it? Did they say you're going to get a lot more pay, like they did with Submariners? I mean, how did they actually persuade them this was a great job to do?
The type of people that they went for, well, first of all, they put out a notice to anybody and everybody that, you know, hazardous service, didn't tell them what it was. We want people for hazardous service. Come and join us, or come and see if you can be selected. Well, you've got lots of people that don't fit into the normal army and navy. You know, they're oddballs, but they're very clever. And they're the people, really, these special units look for. So, you know, Crabb would sit in there and he'd just interview them one after the other. And he knew very quickly whether that person was going to make the grade or not, just by a few minutes of talking. And so these people were allowed to join. But of course, the other units where these guys were didn't want to lose them. Although they might be not the people they really wanted, but they didn't want to lose anybody. So there was a little bit of aggravation, but he managed to sort it out and get the job done.
But the thing that occurred to me there when you were talking about that was that, of course, Buster Crabb, although you don't cover this in your book, I don't think, he ended up disappearing in mysterious circumstances. So he was the oddball's oddball, wasn't he? Even in retirement, he was doing things perhaps he shouldn't have. Is that right?
Yes, he was. I don't go into that in the book because that's a completely separate issue. So, you know, I've written about that in other books. So it's, that was his afterlife, if you want. Because he went into the Navy virtually as a nobody. He was lucky to get in the Navy because he had health problems. And he came out a war hero, and he was. I mean, he got the George Medal for activities that were going on. So he became recognised, and he didn't want to leave. And at the end of the war, the Navy said, well, we've got all these people that have done all this running around. You know, no real control over them. You know, they went off in these different units and did different jobs. There was no coordination, no set training. And the Navy said, that's it. Now we train. So they had the Royal Navy clearance diving branch became established, and the Royal Marines took over the special boats squadron, as it was then.
So when talking about the Royal Marines, which obviously have got a special meaning to you as a Royal Marine who specialised in diving, were the Cockleshell Heroes, the Royal Marines commanded by Blondie Hasler, were they the people that you were most inspired by? And could you tell us a bit about them?
Yeah, Blondie Hasler, he came up with the idea of going down to the Gironde and then up the river to the port and attack ships, which was ruled out by most people because they said you can't go up. It's a long distance. It took days to get up there in canoes. You'll get found out and it won't be a success. In the end, he got his own way. Churchill was very much in favour of all these oddball operations. And that was the start of it. He got these people who would volunteer. He taught them how to dive, taught them how to canoe, and put them through their paces, and they went down there. It was a success to a degree. There's only four of them, actually, four guys got to the end. Other people got caught on the way down there. But they did do damage to ships, and it proved that you could, carry out a mission like that. And one of the other effects, which people don't generally look at, is it put the fear of God up the Germans at that stage because they thought this was a safe port and was virtually unguarded. So to make sure it was safe, they had to take troops from other operations to put them down there to guard the port. So it has different value.
Yeah, so it meant that they had to be wary now, not just of MTBs or warships coming in from the sea, obviously, but also people in small foal boats, is that what they were called? Small canoes as well?
They were two-man Klepper canoes, which they still use.
Right, to this day?
Yeah, to this day.
Right. And the thing that strikes me about the job of combat diver, and you mentioned closed cycle breathing apparatus as well, which plays into this, is that by the nature of it, obviously people have to remain unseen and that they aren't there and they haven't been there. So, I mean, do you think that contributes to the fact that because it's so covert and even betraying yourself with bubbles on the surface mustn't happen, that sometimes the exploits of some of these intrepid people, such as the guys who went in to check and clear the beaches for D-Day, are overlooked or are forgotten? Is that why you wrote the book, to throw a light on them?
I think because the first book was Combat Frogman, which I produced in 1989, and a lot of that was there because people would not know what it was. Well, what do they do? You know, these sort of operations, because nobody talked about them. You know, they were small teams, small groups of people bought in, and they knew it was secret because they gave away there was going to be somebody waiting for them. So it was a very, very closed environment. And then, of course, after the war, people really didn't want to know too much about it. I mean, I worked with, in my very early days, with people that had been in the Navy doing those jobs. And when you talk to them and they said, well, when we come out, there was no work for divers. Nobody wanted to know us, free swimming divers, frogmen, no, nobody wanted to know. And they ended up going round fun fairs, getting in tanks to entertain the public. So that was that was an environment that came, and it's always been like that. You know, people say, oh, the divers are there, but because you go below the surface and that's it, nobody knows what happens, then you're gone.
But one group of people that certainly in recent times that seem to have emerged from below the surface and tend to dominate popular imagination on this sort of thing are, of course, the US Navy SEALs. And so you do devote some time, or rather space, some words to talking about them. So are they're now sort of fixed in people's imaginations. So were there any elements of what they did that were forgotten, or do we know everything about them, do you think?
Well, we won't know everything about them, but they are far more open than anybody else. You know, if you go and ask other organisations, if you go to the MOD and ask them what the SBS are doing at the moment, you know, they'll just, you know, never heard of them. That's the sort of reaction you'll get. You go to America and, oh, yes, come in, buddy, right, sit down now, you know, we're the best, we're the biggest, we've got more. So there's a lot of that in the mix. So that's why they're so well known.
But they had humble beginnings as well, though. Did they start off with World War II and D-Day or beaches in the Pacific? Were they similar in their very beginnings? You know, sort of a band of individuals that went off and did these things that not many people thought about or remembered, do you think?
Yeah, the Americans started off, they had UDT, underwater demolition teams. And they were designed to clear beaches for landing craft. And they were linked into the British at that time because, we taught them, I suppose, in some respects, and then it evolved from that. And then the EUDTs, they went to Korea, and then they went to Vietnam. And in Vietnam, they found that whilst they were very valuable in their underwater skills, they needed to have an upgrade in their land fighting skills. And so this new unit evolved and it became the SEALs, sea, land and air.
And to this day, they are involved in operations which will take them ashore. And the most memorable operation, or the most famous one of the recent era, would be the mission to find, capture or kill Osama bin Laden. So is that something that you cover in your book?
No, I don't, because that didn't involve underwater or warfare in that sense. You know, they do a lot of tasking that is outside. I suppose the bottom line to it all is being a combat diver is the diving part is a means to get from a safe location into a beach or an enemy territory and then do something when you get there. So they're not just trained in diving. You have to have all the military skills that go with it. So you are a special forces person, and then you are a combat diver. So not everybody becomes a combat diver. You know, you have to want to go and do it. and then pass the selection for it and pass the course.
And in recent times in the magazine, thinking of combat divers beyond the Anglosphere, we've actually covered stories about mysterious goings-on in the Baltic, which may or may not be associated with another breed of combat divers, the Russian combat diver, shall we say. And I just wondered what you thought to incidents like the one of 2014 when the Swedes appeared to have intrusions by combat divers or mini-submarines, and then the Nord Stream sabotage attack. Is that something you have any thoughts on? What do you think the veracity is of those reports? Did people imagine that there were combat divers or mini-subs poking around in Swedish or other territorial waters operated by the Russians?
Going back to 1989, I cover in the updated book because more information has come. Because I followed Sweden for the 89 book with their Ministry of Defence on what they were looking for and finding. And there, from their Ministry of Defence, there was mini subs. There were divers had come ashore. They were seen by their military and they were engaged. Firepower. At sea, the ships were dropping depth charges, real ones, in the search for and destroying, you know, submarines. But they never killed anybody on land, and they never actually sunk, to their knowledge, a mini sub or a major submarine. And of course, we had the one that ran aground. It ran aground there, and it was on an operation. It was fitted for carrying craft on its top at the back, behind the fin, and they weren't allowed to go on board it, but they obviously took photographs of it. When you read the what was put in there by the Ministry of Defence in Sweden, you know, that didn't get lost. You know, that was there on a mission, and unfortunately it went to the wrong place and ran aground. And it got stuck there, and eventually the Swedes let it go. But they got a lot of information, or as much as they could, from the ship and where it was and working out all the angles. It was trying to get into one of the ports and get as close as it could. And then, we had the mini sub in the port area, which they were tracking, but couldn't catch it.
And that was the 1980s.
Yeah, that was the 1980s. But then we had a period where there was very little going on, and then all of a sudden it picked up again, and they were being spotted, and the Navy was out there looking for them, because the Swedish put listening devices on the seabed all along their coastline, and they can listen for what's going on. And the Russians were trying to go in and get these listening devices, capture them, cut the cables and take them away to examine them. So there was all this situation going on. And then added to that, there was the cables being cut in Norway, where sections of cable going out to listening devices were cut and taken away.
When was that? That was
the last couple of years.
Oh, right. Yeah,
yeah, it's fairly recently. So I go into that and talk about that in the book, and the wheres and the whys and how it could have been done.
Yeah,
all ships are tracked. They have a pinging device on them, and they can be tracked. But the vessels that were around didn't have their devices switched on. And happened to be Russian. So it could have been a trawler, but it could have been divers going down. So it's quite a mishmash of what's going on. And then there's the island with the listening stations on, and that had a cable cut, and a section of it taken away.
The thing about Sweden is that Sweden, certainly during the Cold War and ostensibly until the current application to join NATO, is a neutral country that may work with NATO. They call it Partnership for Peace, or they did call it that, in exercises, but it's not aligned to NATO. Do you think the Russians were cutting bits of cable off the Swedish coast? Why were they so interested in Sweden?
Oh, the cutting of the cables was actually Norway.
Yeah, but when they not take the communication cable samples from Sweden as well.
It's gathering intelligence. And I mean, we're seeing this very much now with Ukraine. Ukraine is not a member of NATO, so Russia can do what it wants.
Right.
And it's doing to a degree. And, you know, nobody else gets involved. If they started doing it visibly and you could locate them in Norway, that would be a different matter because they're a member of NATO. So it's Russia will pick on the weakest link. You know, if you're not in NATO, you've got a problem.
And
that's the way it worked since my first investigations back in 89 or in the 80s.
And then there's been the further instance in 2014, which is around the time of the annexation of Crimea and the invasion, so-called covert invasion of eastern Ukraine. There were incidents then, weren't there? And then we've had the Nord Stream incident as well. So what do you think to those episodes?
Well, the Nord Stream, it wasn't actually in use when it was hit, but the reports that are coming out of what happened were that it was destruction by explosives. Well, in the depths of water we're talking about there, you're going to be on not combat diver kit, you're going to be on deeper sea diving kit if you're going to go down and do that. Or you use a submarine, which the Russians have lots of and are evolving and developing massively in the last, 5-10 years, to use divers, deep water, and do all sorts of operations. They understand that if we have communications or oil or gas running or anything like that underwater, you know, a very quick fix by sticking some explosives on there, shaped charges, you can suddenly end it. And so who actually did it? Well, it's the old thing, isn't it? You need the evidence to put the guilty in the dock, but they haven't got that. You know, it was blown up, but I don't see any reason for any of NATO or even Sweden as it is now to want to go and destroy that pipeline. There's easier ways of doing things.
Right, yeah. The focus of the world's attention at the moment is on, much of the world's attention, not all of the world's attention, is on the Ukraine war. At the moment, they're debating tanks, and then in the past it was missiles or the no-fly zone. So that war, which has raged for almost a year now, has dominated the headlines and thoughts of who did Nord Stream, etc. But, of course, combat diving is not just a European, you know, Russian and NATO, a European thing. It's around the world. So in your very comprehensive book, I mean, you look at some of the little-known units. So are there any there you'd highlight as being particularly proficient beyond the Anglosphere, beyond Europe, and where we're all focused at the moment?
Certainly Australia. Australia has a very effective, they call them clearance divers, but they are aligned into the Australian Special Air Service and their commando units for security and for if they have to, combat roles into neighbouring countries and, of course, part of the defence. So they're very, very active. They've got a lot of people involved, so they keep their numbers up, keep the training. And there's a lot of exchange. There's lots of exchange goes on between NATO countries and even in the Far East, they work with the Philippines. The Philippines were very, very helpful. They're one of the, what I would call one of the smaller, they don't have the budgets to create large organisations, but they're very, very effective and they're very well trained. In many of those cases, or particularly the Philippines, of course, the US Navy SEALs went down there and assisted them in their the way that they can do things and operate. And they've based their system very much on the American system.
And an unusual contest, which we've covered in the magazine a little bit, is that between Israel and Hamas, because people generally probably don't understand or ever hear much about the fact that there are combat divers from Hamas who are trying to infiltrate Israel and attack targets there as well.
Yeah, that's been going on for quite a long time. They've moved across now to closed circuit equipment. Before, they would come with scuba equipment with all the bubbles coming up and be spotted. Now they can come in more covertly. But that's an ongoing situation. I don't ever see an end to that. But yeah, Hamas have got themselves trained and can go and they can get in onto the beaches. They could attack the harbours. So Israel has the task of it's got its own divers and they can counterattack. But, you know, you have to defend their ports and docks. So it's a whole new game of things going on that people really don't know about.
And also mysterious and new, bring things back to the Black Sea and Ukraine. And something that you have a very interesting analysis of in your book is the episode at the Sea of Azov port of Berdyansk that happened last April. And you've done an analysis of what is available out there in open source intelligence. So you have theories about what may have actually happened there. I mean, in the magazine, we said it was likely to be ammunition handling in a landing ship in Berdyansk, the Saratov, a Russian Navy landing ship that, you know, somebody dropped a cigarette or whatever. And that's why that landing ship blew up. Have you got any thoughts on that, that aspect of the Ukraine war?
Yeah, I managed to get the footage. There are two cameras on land that reach out and cover that long jetty that where the ships were there, and it was running, and the footage is there to see. And when the ship actually goes, you start to see smoke coming off it. The camera zooms in. The first thing that came over and said, well, it was hit by a rocket or a missile from Ukraine. The thing was with that, at that time, Ukraine had unguided missiles, and it would have been the very limit of their capability. And when you look at the port side there, there's towers which carry fuel. The dock area itself, there's a crane, but none of it's damaged. The chances of you firing a rocket over its maximum distance and then hitting that ship with one missile is, well, I don't believe it. If you had a guided weapon, you know, where they're guiding it and to go in, a cruise missile, then that would be different. Then looking, you can watch the ship as this thing evolves. And they were, first of all, the jetty was clear. There's no stores parked on the jetty. It's absolutely clear there is nothing. There are no people about. This ship is just sitting there. It would have been, I would have think it would be empty of ammunition. If there was ammunition on there, it would have been stored in systems that you can actually lift it off with a crane without problems and move it around. I would very much doubt, stand to be corrected, but I very much doubt that it was a failure on the ammunition on the ship, just because of the way that the explosions went. It went from the bow to the stern, and a lot of it was coming from waterline area. You could see the smoke coming up, it's clear. And then the ship starts to evolve. Then you start to get explosions on board the ship. In front of it, which is quite a way away, there was a merchant ship parked there. It also was set alight, but the stern of it, and when you see the smoke coming off it, from what you can actually see, I would have said that that was either a big lump of molten steel coming blown off from the landing ship that hit that one on the back end of it, lucky hit. But there was explosions going off then, which you would get from a ship anyway, the way they're built, and you get lumps coming off it. And then that ship is the one that's now fully afire. There's nobody there trying to put it out. There's no fire engines on the jetty. There's nothing arrives. It is now on fire. Nobody to be seen. And the landing ship, one of its sister ships, is parked behind it. It starts to move away because it's now on fire. And it's moving away. Now, what caused that? We don't know, but it looks from the superstructure as opposed to the water line. And then the third one was parked around the corner, and that one moved away. So it's all very, very visual on what you can actually see, and quite close up from both sides of the jetty itself. And from that, I don't say it was done by combat frogmen. What I say is it's a more or less a classic textbook matter of how they could have done it. And they could have come from land because it was occupied Ukraine, so they could have got people in there and small amounts of equipment. They could have gone in and done it. One thing that I have to say is, and I'm linked into the Ukrainian Special Forces combat divers, so I get photographs and things from them.
Right, amazing.
They are absolutely the elite. They got the Americans went out there, the SEALs, and the British, our SBS, when they took Zimy Island, and they used underwater craft, swimmer delivery vehicles to go in on that attack. That was the SBS trained them on that. So they've had enormous training to go in. I mean, one of the latest things I've found is when they got to the river, the Dnipro River, the Russians were on one side and Ukrainians were on the other. And the Russians pulled back because they could be attacked by artillery. And then they were going to come, then they started to come forward, but there were lots of villages. And there was about 500 people were in a serious situation, but they were older people, women and children. So the young men were in the army and they hadn't got there yet. And they were going to be threatened. And the Russian policy is quite clear. If they're old and young, or old people rather, then we just annihilate them. They're either going to be with us or against us. And these people were against them. So they just shoot them. And then, of course, they want to rape the women and kill them. So it's a pretty serious situation. And the Ukrainian special combat divers went and got 500 people out beneath the noses of the Russians. So I've got that. I'm starting to put stuff on the web. So, yeah, they're incredibly well trained. And when there's lots of things going on out there that we don't know about, obviously they're not going to tell us. Where their special forces and they're recruiting. There's lots of recruiting going on and they will do an effective job.
Yeah. So when it came to getting those people across the river, would the scenario have been just to guess or speculate that the combat divers would have gone across the river under the guns, shall we say, to keep it simple, of the Russians located in the various villages, the people that needed to escape, and then brought them down to the riverbank, and then got them across the banks.
Put them in inflatable boats.
Yeah. At night, probably at night, would you say?
Yeah. And then they disappeared. So when the Russians got there, there was nobody left.
Amazing. And when you, that Zimy Island, do you mean Snake Island? Is that what you mean? Or is that different?
Yeah.
All right, Snake Island. Is that something that's generally known that they would have done that? Is that something you've got a special insight to?
No. First of all, it's a Ukrainian island. And it's if you can hold that and defend it with weaponry, you can defend the sea passage in for cargo ships going into Odessa. That's the background to that. The Russians attacked it with a force, and the Ukrainians on there were captured. That was pretty much flagged up in the media, the national, the world's media.
Yeah, but I mean the special forces side of it. I mean
Well, they came later. Then the Russians were on there, and for whatever reason, the Russians pulled their people off, but they couldn't figure out whether there's a small group left there. So the Ukrainians wanted to wave the flag and say, hang on a minute, that's our island. We're going to come back and tell you it's ours. So they went in and the combat divers went in first. They had swimmer delivery vehicles, which they didn't have before. They were able to land. They cleared the beach, made sure it was safe. Then other special forces came in and they had engineers and other people with them. They came in and landed. They made sure there was nobody on the island, and there wasn't. The Russians cleared off as soon as they'd actually realised that Ukrainians had landed. And then they put flags up everywhere, their flags up, including the flag of the Ukrainian divers. And then they didn't stay there long. They were pulled out because the Russians came back with a whole bunch of... But it's all part of this testing and where they're going to turn up next.
And thinking of where they're going to turn up next, and this is maybe not something you'd comment on at all, or that you have no knowledge of, but when we look at the road bridge between from the Crimean Peninsula, I think, is it called the Kerch?
Yeah.
Kerch Road Bridge or the Azov Road Bridge. And I've watched the video. I mean, that's all that's available. And we've listened to what the Russians said. But does that something that would indicate to you that there was any combat diver or anything like that involvement?
I don't think we've got enough footage to actually really determine it. People are only showing us what they want to. And that was really the main part of the bridge. I understand it was reopened shortly afterwards or had limited ability, but it's the sort of thing that their special forces engaged in.
And I suppose one of the things about special forces, it's the same with submarines, anything that's hidden, unseen, strikes from the deep or wherever and then disappears again. It's psychological as well, isn't it? Even if your people have never been there, the fact that you have people trained to do that, even if you don't use them and they're not involved in something, it puts a kind of sense of fear into the opponent and makes them worried about a lot of things, doesn't it? Even though those guys might not actually have been involved in a particular mission.
Yeah, and it's very, very difficult to guard a port or a dock. If you take a classic one, if you look at the entrance to Portsmouth and Southampton, you know, to guard that and defend that is, it's not an easy situation. You know, you can't just send half a dozen bodies down there and say, well, guard this. If you look at all of that, that's quite complex, especially with the equipment they've got with swimmer delivery vehicles now and the evolution that's coming from them. And, of course, you go in then into submarines with their dry deck shelters, which we go into in some detail in the book, and you know, how you can carry all this stuff in. And it's all out of sight. You'll never see it. If you've got listening devices on the seabed, you might hear about it. But, you know, it's do all those launchings further away so they're out of the range of listening.
Yeah, so that is something that's actively underway in... many navies to use, as you say, dry deck shelters, which are these kind of little tubes that you stick a little mini, very mini submersible in the swimmer delivery vehicle, and then, as you say, you send the people in from out to sea, and that obviously requires highly trained human beings, specialists, elite forces. But of course, these days the drone is in the ascendant. So could we see a time when instead of people in swimmer delivery vehicles coming out of these dry deck shelters piggybacking on submarines, it's just drones, that they've taken the human out of the equation in combat diving? It's no longer combat diving, it's just combat undersea drones, undersea autonomous vehicles. Do you think the humans will still be there, or will they soon be gone from this arena of warfare?
No, I think they're going to be there. The divers are going to be there. Interesting analogy I can give to that is, working in the North Sea in diving, one of the first remote operated vehicles was put on board where we were with a dive team, and these guys came out and said, "You're all redundant. You know, this can do anything you can do." And we said, "Okay." So we watched it as it went to work, and then sort of half an hour later they come and said, "Can your people go down and untie us, because we've got ourselves wrapped around the structure?"
Right.
And even to this day, divers have never been replaced by vehicles, and there are some very sophisticated vehicles out there. It's difficult to explain without a sort of visual aid, but docks have booms, they have safety where you try and stop people from getting in. I mean, they might have nets on to stop craft coming underwater, and it's you've got to navigate those booms. Now, if you send in a remote vehicle, autonomous vehicle, it will be pre-programmed, because transmission of instructions underwater are quite limited still. They're working very hard. There's lots of people working on experiments and things like that for communications underwater. So the vehicle, you've got to, you get to this net, you've got to get through it or under it. and getting a vehicle to actually do that. And then when you get inside, they have other obstacles that they put out, essentially to stop humans doing it. But it would certainly stop a remote vehicle because suddenly it would come to a halt. So you've got all these problems to be surmounted. Eventually there'll be vehicles that can do it, but it's a way off yet. Because you've got to have the battery power for a start to drive these vehicles, because you use a lot of battery power in water to take a vehicle along. So you can program it, which is what they do now, and it will dive down and it will go along, say, a pipeline, and it can take photographs and footage of a pipeline. And so, yeah, that's easy to do. And then when it's finished what it's got to do, it comes up and then you go and collect it. But when you want it to actually do an attack on a target, it becomes a different matter.
And I suppose if you get a more advanced undersea drone that can take orders via some wonderful new transmitting device or a practice, that then gives an enemy the opportunity to sever the communication link or just jam the signals. And, you know, for every measure, there's a countermeasure. And so then the drone becomes useless again, doesn't it?
Yeah. One of the I can't remember if I cover it in the book now. It's this surface craft. It's a black. They found it beached in Russia, and it's full of explosives, and it's guided, so you can use satellites to go. And they swarmed Sevastopol,
yes,
with these devices, and that was sort of a classic of drones being used, but you couldn't get it in to the harbour because of the booms and the safety that they had on that. You know, that needs to be open. You need to be able to steer it and drive it. But of course, you're trying to do that from a long way away. And whilst in the air, you've got free access and you can drive your aircraft or whatever it is you've got, your drone, up in the sky around. In water, it is more difficult. But what you could do, you could put your combat divers ashore covertly in the area of where you're going to attack, so that they could take over command of this thing once it gets closer, so that then they can actually joystick it to go round obstacles and then attack the target. So that's a possibility, you know, down the line.
Yeah, so in essence, as we wrap up our fascinating chat, the book, your book, it's a very comprehensive book. It's well written, and I think it won't be beaten when it comes to a profile of combat divers of the world and all their exploits, and it's very up to date. So you've written that book that looks back on the beginnings, World War II through to today, and then we've got a flavour of and elements of the Ukraine War. But are we saying, I think, in conclusion, that combat divers, in essence, will be with us for decades to come, do you think?
They're going to be with us for a long time, definitely. Yeah. There'll be aids by, if you want to put a combat diver in to do the job, then they will be able to do it, whereas a robot would find more complications. But they're improving dramatically, but I don't think they'll take over from people.
No. So those special people will still be needed, are still needed.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much for that chat, Mike. Really brilliant and fascinating in all manner of ways. So thanks very much for coming on as a guest on Warships Pod.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me.
For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at Warships IFR, and also Twitter at Warships IFR. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.